Hi, it's Helen Hebert, and I'm here in St. Paul, Minnesota, at the home and studio of Mary Hark, Hark Handmade Paper. And it's July, what is it, 12th?
Yes.
Yeah, July 12th, 2016. And Mary, I'd love to hear what the initial spark was for you with paper. How did you get
it? It was a gift from the universe and completely unexpected. I was in a master's program in textiles at the University of Iowa the year that Tim Barrett arrived to start the Iowa Center for the Book. And I applied not really knowing what paper was, but it was a work study position to be his assistant. In the very first year he was there, there were two positions.
And you were an undergraduate?
No, I was in a master's program.
Master's, okay.
And I was selected to be in that position, and I was in his very first class. And I had no idea what papermaking even was.
Uh-huh.
And I fell in love.
Yeah.
It was an incredible gift. And I was in a situation where, that was 1980. That was in the late 80s, and the word craft was not a word that was very revered in art school.
Mm-hmm.
And here was a guy that would stand up in front of the class unabashedly say he was a craftsman. And it was clear he understood the art of paper and in paper, but he was committed to craft in a way that I had never experienced.
Mm.
And it resonated so powerfully with me. So I finished that MA program in textiles, and my thesis show was about 50% paper and 50% textile, with a very seamless, in a very seamless way. The paper became an extension of the textile, and I used it in all the ways I was using cloth. I used it, I dyed it in traditional textile ways, I printed on it, I approached it as a crisp, the crisp end of a textile continuum.
And what kind of paper were you making? Because I know Tim does Eastern and Western.
Right, both. Absolutely both.
So,
I was using the Japanese papers, which worked so well with shibori and indigo dyeing, and then I was using long-beaten flax and also mixing the Japanese fiber with the flax to create a wonderful translucent papers that had strength when they were wet.
Mm-hmm.
I just really, Tim was earnestly giving us so much information about the craft, and I was breaking every rule. I'm sure I was his worst student. but I'm so grateful to him. And I'll always be grateful for the information that he shared. At the time, if he assigned us 50 sheets, he looked at 50 sheets, and I would just roll my eyes and think, oh, come on. And then we would do beater tests, which I couldn't bear because
right.
I wanted to get to whatever I wanted to get to. And now those beater tests are the first thing I do in every class I teach, and they're essential.
Mm-hmm.
And they're essential to my understanding of what's possible. Tim Barrett's class gave me a huge part of my life.
Uh-huh.
His generosity was tremendous, and his knowledge was really unparalleled. And it was truly an unexpected gift.
Oh, that's so cool. And so then what did you do after you graduated?
Well, I finished the MA, and I had a couple of little kids in tow. I had very young children. And I was invited by Iowa to go into the MFA program in printmaking, but I felt uncertain that that was the right thing to do, and there was no MFA in textiles, and paper at that time was kind of an extension of the print department, unlike where it is now. And I had a very generous instructor, Naomi Shadle, who ran the textile program, and she was really a mentor, and she said, this is what you're going to do. You're going to apply to Cranbrook, the California College of Arts and Crafts, Chicago School Art Institute, and then Bloomington.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of I had very young children, and a complicated personal life at the time, and I just thought, oh, all right, whatever. Because I thought maybe I'd get a degree and teach art, or mm-hmm. I thought I needed to take care of myself and my children in a practical way. But I just did what she said. And I got a call, I can remember it, I was in a car. I got a call in April, and it was the School of the Art Institute offering me a full ride 2 years to the MFA.
Wow.
And then I got a call from Cranbrook with a similar offer.
Uh-huh.
And I, for a whole bunch of different reasons, I ended up in Chicago,
uh-huh.
which having spent 2 years in Iowa, really being taught by, well, Naomi was very conceptual, but Tim really, you know, it was beater times. It was about the materials and the processes. And all of a sudden I was in a school that was really committed to conceptual work. And I was really in over my head, and I was very anxious.
In what department were you in?
I was in fiber and material studies.
Okay.
And I remember thinking perhaps I shouldn't have come, you uh-huh. know. I mean, people were saying, and by people I mean incredibly wonderful teachers like Ann Wilson and Joan Livingstone mm-hmm. and among mm-hmm. others, who were really generous, intelligent teachers, but they were pushing me in ways I have never been pushed, and it was scary.
Yeah.
And I didn't know if I had it in me, uh-huh. you know.
Uh-huh.
And but they were... they, in a very professional way, not in a, you know, they encouraged me.
Uh-huh.
And so that first year, I was also, there was no beater there. There was no paper department.
Right.
So I was working in Hungerford. What's his first
Rick.
Name? Rick Hungerford we worked out an arrangement where I did some studio cleaning for him, and then I used his beater, and then I would carry the material. If you can believe it, I would carry the buckets from his studio in Chicago. I was young. I had energy. Back to the studios in downtown Chicago. And
so wait a minute. Rick did teach through the school for a while. That was before
he
or
was,
after
he
you?
Was, he taught happening. Paper at Columbia, and you could take paper. But for a variety of reasons, that wasn't something I chose to do.
Okay.
But anyway, I had access to his beater.
Yeah.
And then, in a very can-do, with a very can-do attitude, I started making very large pieces, really 6-8-foot square pieces, which I would make in my studio on the 7th floor of a building in downtown Chicago,
uh-huh.
where I would lay out blankets, and then I would lay a giant curtain from Pier 1, and then blankets. And then I would, with many small molds, I would build a large piece, and then I would air dry it, and it would shrink all in funny ways.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would, with wire brushes and water and this and that, I would flatten it, and I made these huge topographies. And perhaps in my life, those were the most important things that I had made.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember sitting in front of them, and just, I was completely engaged. I didn't care what anyone said. I loved them. I loved to look at them.
Yeah.
And they had been very physical to make, and I could never have made them in Iowa because I broke kind of every rule about how to do stuff.
Right.
And in Chicago, no one cared about the material. They cared about what they were looking at. Oh, yes, the fact that they were paper became part of the conversation, but paper wasn't driving the bus.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And that was also very helpful. Is still helpful to me in the way I think as both an educator and as a maker. I finished that those 2 years in Chicago, and went to Iowa and taught for 1 year, was invited back for 1 year. And
taught paper making?
I taught in the textile department.
Textile. And what was your graduate thesis? Was that paper or textile?
My graduate thesis in Chicago, I forget the name of it, but I made 5 large, they were about 7-foot square topographies.
Okay.
And I also was buying paper from ICOs and collaging
mm-hmm.
things.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
So you taught 1 year.
1 year in Iowa.
Uh-huh.
Naomi invited me, kindly invited
uh-huh.
me back when I didn't get anything. And then... job at McAllister opened up, and that was a 2/3 time job running the fibers program.
McAllister College in St. Paul.
And I had connections in Minnesota, and I thought this is a good place for my kids to grow up, and McAllister is an excellent school, and I also think I knew in my own heart of hearts, I don't think I said it out loud, but I know it now, I couldn't have had a tenure track position and had the domestic life that I had, which was very important to me with my mm-hmm. young children. Mm-hmm. And then I was artist in residence for 3 years at the Minnesota Center for Book Arts. So I joined a very vibrant community. I had access to a studio and equipment. I was teaching at a wonderful school with great students.
Did you teach textiles at McAllister? Did you
I taught Fibers studio? 1 and Fibers 2. It could be anything I wanted, okay. And paper became a very large part of it.
So did you set up a facility?
Yep. So one of those beaters that okay. was in the garage mm-hmm. was part of that, and we built a paper facility there, we created a triangle with the Minnesota Center for Book Arts, so work-study students from McAllister were building equipment, which is still big part. All those tables that are in the paper studio were all built by my mm-hmm, students. Mm-hmm. And then we could take the students down. The exchange was we built the equipment. The students came and we could have classes at MCBA. So okay. the McAllister students became very engaged at the center, and we created a situation called, I forget what it was called, but it was something like student paper maker in residence, so that it was at a time when, in a sense, it was all off the books. We could do what we wanted to do. And mm-hmm. it was lovely. Yeah. And so I continued that life, and I built, I would say about 1/3 of my, or maybe a little less than that, maybe 1/5 of my income was from production paper jobs. And I also was making artwork, which I've come to call constructed paintings, which are paper and cloth collaged into painterly objects that hang on the wall that are highly influenced by textile traditions, along mm-hmm. with other things. And I exhibited, and I built a record for myself. And I also became very involved with the Purpich Center for Arts Education, doing consulting work across Minnesota, going into public schools, often representing book arts concerns. So outstate schools would get grants, and they would come with a person like me that would coach the teachers into integrating arts activities across mm-hmm. the curriculum. Mm-hmm. So, of course, paper and books was a natural.
Right.
And did work in the northern Minnesota Indian reservations and inner city North Minneapolis, and was really an education for me in terms of honing my skills as a teacher and as a person interested in community engagement and mm-hmm. using the arts as a vehicle for finding meaning. And so I was scrappy. I our family motto was, it was a rich life with a cash flow problem. And it was a rich life. And my kids grew up in the middle of all kinds of wonderful arts activity, and we lived kind of close to the bone.
Uh-huh.
In 2005, the children were in college, and I applied for a Fulbright and received a Fulbright to Sub-Saharan Africa for 1 year in 2006. So it was a wonderful capstone to 15 years of working as a teacher, as a working artist, as a production paper maker, just really working hard but engaged in things that I loved, and raising the kids.
Yeah, and so when you applied for the Fulbright, you had a project in mind? Did you know someone in Africa?
Well, my oldest daughter had had a semester in Africa. I'd been very in Ghana. I'd had a very deep interest in Ghanaian textile, or in West African textiles, for a long time, which I think permeated her own consciousness
sure.
while she ended up there. And she invited me, and we toured for 6 weeks in 2003. And at that time, I met, through my daughter, I met faculty at the university in Kumasi, who then I met again when they were on Fulbright's themselves in Athens, Georgia, and I was teaching at Penland, and I invited them to Penland as a visiting artist, and so it was this big circle, and at that moment they said, apply for a Fulbright, I'll sponsor you.
Okay.
And so I applied for a Fulbright, and it was based on a textile, it was not a teaching Fulbright, it was a
research,
so I had the freedom to set up a studio and to really be engaged in the textile culture. And while I was there, I, at a certain point, went to the university in Kumasi and said, these are my skills. I could do these different things, and I was interested in meeting and being around my peers, university trained artists, because I had been around a lot of traditional makers. And I ended up teaching a 6-week hand paper making workshop there.
Okay.
And that started a whole nother adventure, which I'm still engaged in. And it also helped me to produce a body of work that I produced in Ghana, which was exhibited both at the museum, at the National Museum in Ghana, and at a variety of places in the U.S. after I came back.
And so what was the papermaking facility? Or
so you said so that we... There was no papermaking facility, and the art department was on an extremely low budget, and I was assigned the third-year printmakers, which were 40 students and a graduate student. And we decided, the university there is on like a botanical garden, and so we decided to, using the plants that were available and very modest equipment, pounding things in mortar and pestles, and we built a small press. I brought a couple of molds and decals that had been built by the students at McAllister College before I left, and we set out to see what kind of paper we could find from local plants. And along the way, we were getting gorgeous paper, and it was so much fun, and these students were so engaged. But, I mean, we're talking no electricity. We had to carry the water. So, I mean...
You were hand-beating.
Hand-beating in mortar and pestles. We were cooking everything on coal pots outside. But I had brought a box of Kozo that I had ordered from Carriage House, and it came to Minnesota, and I carried it to Ghana, thanks to the Fulbright program that would let you bring supplies. And so I brought out some of my Kozo, and we started adding it to the plantain and the cashew and the local plants, and it exponentially, of course, improved the quality of the paper without really making a dent in the texture and the color, etc. So when this project was, when this workshop was over, there's been so much interest. I thought, how can we keep it going? And I went to the to FORIG, which is like the DNR, the Forest Industry of Ghana, and I brought some of the Kozo, and I said, what do we have in Ghana that might have some of these properties? And they pulled out this big poster, danger, pulp mulberry, if you see this plant, burn it. Well, it turned out that in 1969, the president of Ghana had brought over 14 pulp mulberry plants from China. He had planted them in a forest preserve outside of Kumasi, and then he was booted out of office.
For making paper?
Yes, for exploring the possibility of a paper industry.
Wow.
He was killed in a coup. And these 14 plants languished. Of course, no one cared or knew about the project. That was 69. Then there was there were droughts. Then there were fires. The forest canopy was raised. And once the forest canopy was raised, these 14 plants started to grow, and they are now the most insidious, non-indigenous plant in the central forest region of Ghana. And this is like Kozo that you've never seen before. This is 30-foot high trees. These are, when you pull back the bark of a one-year-old, you've just never seen fiber like this.
Right.
And my jaw, when I was touring, I mean, they were burning it. They didn't know what to do about it, and nobody was thinking about paper.
Right.
And the following year, I joined the faculty at University of Wisconsin, which is a big research university. And one of the first things my mentor said to me is, well, we know you're a good teacher, but you got to get some research projects going if you want to get tenure. So I wrote my first grant that September, and it was funded. And in December of my first semester, I was back in Ghana, And I have been back every year now for now some months. I'm about to leave. I'm leaving Saturday for a month and a half. Working on building this project, and it's been funded by the university. Now, that funding is going to run out because times are changing.
Right.
But this decade has yielded the development of a small community of artists and horticulturalists who are interested in the paper. It's now become an itinerant... I thought it could be housed at the university, but we had problems with that. So over the years, we have a Valley Beater that was more or less donated by Jana Pullman, my dear friend from that first class in Iowa.
Uh-huh.
We were in that first class together, and we're still dear friends. We've built equipment. We have a beautiful press and many molds and decals. But the thing is itinerant, so it comes out for projects and for workshops. And we've successfully produced one book. We have two more books in production. And now we're working on a project called Designed Objects, where we're working with a local forge, a very artful forge. They do burglar bars and gates and things like this, but they do it in an exceptionally artful way. And we're creating folding screens and lampshades and things that we're covering with handmade paper, with the idea of creating a bank of possibility that could be drawn upon for a high-end market in Accra. There's money in Ghana. It's just not well distributed.
Mm-hmm.
There's oil in Ghana now, along with other, you know, cocoa and coffee. And there are hotels coming up hand over fist that have 400 a night rooms.
Mm.
And interior designers are going to Dubai and China to get objects that look like medieval Europe to populate the lobbies of these. And we're hoping to be an alternative, to produce a beautifully designed objects that could be not in a catalog for sale, but people could look at what we do, and mm-hmm. then we could work with designers to create objects that are from Ghana, made by Ghanaian artisans, of Ghanaian materials, so that our project can be funded. And our goal is to have a small workshop in which this kind of activity takes place, and adjunct to it what we're calling a design incubator, which would be a place for Ghanaian artists, artists from other parts of the African continent, as well as Europe and America, to come and work with the Ghanaian Kozo to do, you know, would be a residency type project. But the workshop would hire people to produce paper. We're also doing a paper bag initiative. We got a bunch of irons in the fire. It's slow, slow, as we say in Ghana, slow, slow.
Right.
But it's the potential is there, and we're really on the precipice. And my commitment is to have Ghanaian funding and Ghanaian makers, and not be a development project run by people who think they know better from somewhere else.
Right.
And my dream is to walk away from something that's fully, in you know, fully sustained by its own. Now that's a big.
Yeah, so
dream.
Are things happening when you're not there, or is it pretty
no,
much
well,
it comes out
when
you're
small,
there?
Small.
Yeah.
And there are things like there's a big art exhibit right now in Accra, and there is a presence of handmade paper there.
Mm-hmm.
That is a, you know, there are things, but it's, you know, introducing a new craft completely is not easy.
Yeah.
Sustaining things when there's no ongoing funding. There's certainly interest, but people need to be paid. Otherwise,
yeah,
they can't.
Sure.
If I leave the equipment, it's not well taken care of. And so I just made the decision that it was too valuable to have it. It's just like anywhere. If I leave equipment in Madison and there's not some kind of protocol for taking care of it, it is also not well taken care of.
Right.
But then if you're in an economy of scarcity, there is even more chance that people will grab it or it won't be well taken
right.
care of.
And what about the Ghanaian Kozo? What
the Ghanaian Kozo is...
Are people harvesting that?
You could never use it up.
Right.
The only people that are... this small group of people that are harvesting it for paper, but this is the thing... it could also be for export for papermakers. South Africa is interested. Johannesburg, I'll be doing workshops there this year.
Mm-hmm.
The East Africa interest, I mean, Carriage House
right.
has said, send it to us, show us. But making the leap into being a businesswoman mm-hmm. is a, as you might know,
yeah.
is hard. It doesn't come natural for me, and I have to figure out how I can be part of the story, not as a development person who's donating her time.
Right.
But you know, I'm trying to. My vision is for a for-profit business, even mm-hmm. if that profit is mm-hmm. marginal. It's not. I don't want to write grants. I also Kim Berman in South Africa has been incredibly generous with what has worked and really not worked
right.
for Phenomi Papers. I mean, it was a great idea, and she spent endless hours writing grants, keeping
right.
it running.
Right.
And I don't have it in me to do that. And I also, in the long run, I don't think that's a contribution. I think the contribution mm-hmm. is to... So when I go, I always teach one or two workshops. I teach workshops at all over the country in Ghana to educators in art departments, in art centers, trying to give people access to this more or less free resource. Now I'm working with people from FORIG who are helping me to write a business plan. So these are Ghanaian leaders in the forest industry and also in the climate change. These are people that are players in the climate change mm-hmm. Conversation mm-hmm. in Ghana.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, you know, people are super interested in the project, and having produced the one book which is successfully vetted by major museums all over the world has given it credibility. So I can sit down with a high-end businessman in Ghana and say, here's a story of my project up until now, and see this object?
Mm-hmm.
These museums have collected it, and they might not really understand what paper can be, but they understand a cultural vetting,
right?
And
right.
it gives it credibility, and all of a sudden it's turned around, and they're like, what? No, tell me more, right? So I think what I'm at is at the stage where very soon I need to be there again for a year, or certainly for a half a year, if we can get funding to make one of these projects, if we can get a paper bag order. Paper bags are exotic, high-end
right.
objects.
Yeah.
So high-end restaurants and boutiques in Ghana are buying paper bags that are being produced by boutique makers in small enterprises, and they're getting their paper from China and Germany.
Mm-hmm.
They can't really afford our handmade paper. That paper is pretty cheap,
right.
but they like the idea. And uh-huh. if they could do one run of
right.
high-end paper bags that has this beautiful Ghanaian
right.
story,
right.
it's good for their business. We want to be a small operation. We don't want to make all the paper bags in the country. But,
right.
you know, so we're right on the precipice of these things happening, and I go and come in a way it's tied to me.
Right.
And
wow. Okay, so wow.
I think
I
I'll
mean,
stop there, yeah.
That's a whole job in itself. But you wear many hats. So I know you did a big community project here
yeah.
in your community. I want to hear about that.
So I live in Frogtown, which is the immigrant neighborhood of St. Paul, and it is a neighborhood of... small no home ownership, not much money. And I have a beautiful home in this neighborhood, which was rehabbed by an artist organization. And my next door neighbor, Setu Jones, is a very important artist in our region and a player nationally. And he came in on the same project. So we agreed to live in the neighborhood. Initially, we got a great deal on our homes. And the flip side was you agreed to be here for a while and to be good citizens. And it was a gift. It was wonderful. And now we've been here 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And Setu has become a very important community organizer for Frogtown, especially with community gardens. And he's very interested in food and the intersection of food and art, and received massive funding to create this community meal in which 2,000 neighbors would sit down at a half-mile-long table right down the middle of our neighborhood, and that table would end at what will become the Frogtown Farm, which is going to be a really wonderful and lively urban garden. Setu wanted me to be part of the project, and I said, well, I would love to make placemats. But I said, here's the deal. If we do it, I need to be able to hire a team And we have to have a commitment to making beautiful paper. It can't be crummy paper. And the people that work for me at the end of the summer are going to understand the craft.
Mm-hmm.
And our contribution will be, you know, these beautiful, well-made sheets of paper. And he got the funding, and I was able to hire a small crew, a local crew, including immigrants from Mexico, African-American woman, my age, a new college student, a group of people, very diverse in age, in race, in education. And we were able to get buy equipment that would allow us to take our papermaking enterprise to every corner of the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And we were committed to making paper out of waste material from the neighborhood. So our papers were 90% urban bio waste and urban textile waste. We made paper out of burdock, out of tulip, out of daylily, out of, you know, all the, out of hosta, out of out of junk growing in the alley, along with t-shirts and things that people brought over. And our papers were beautifully made with high-end equipment. And my garage, which was just filmed in the little film that Helen made, all the equipment was there, and we would roll it out every morning. The team would show up. By the middle of the afternoon, we had all kinds of people here. There were days when we had 4 different languages being spoken in my driveway.
Mm-hmm.
The little kids were the first to come, and then they would bring their parents. We had people down the alley that work in kitchens, you know, local kitchens, new immigrants, who would come at the end of the day to help us clean up and bring food for us.
Yeah.
We had little kids that were speaking Somali and Ethiopian and Spanish and Hmong, teaching their parents and their aunties and how to make paper.
So how did the days look? Like, did you cook fiber one day, beat it?
No, we had everything going on all the time because we were going through a lot of material.
Yeah.
So we had the cook set up in my yard,
mm-hmm.
and we just took turns with everything, and everyone became highly trained.
Yeah.
So my team was trained on all the equipment and on the process, but they were also trained to be teachers,
mm-hmm.
and on safety with
mm-hmm.
a lot of people coming for a short amount of time. And then about every other weekend, we went to a different corner of the neighborhood where we would find somebody that had a spigot that they would let us hook up to. And we had Lee McDonald's Oracle beater hooked up to a bicycle.
Uh-huh.
And we set up on the sidewalk, and people that were walking to the grocery store, to the bus, or to the train would stop. All kinds of, every kind of person.
Yeah.
Every kind of person. And they would make a sheet of paper, and then they were curious. What?
Yeah.
And then they, you know, some of the people, they weren't interested in the paper, but they loved the machine. You know, and people would get on the machine, and they loved to pedal and produce the paper. And, you know, it was interesting to me because I've taught many workshops, and many hand paper making workshops take place at wonderful art centers, which are populated with middle-class white people, because that's who comes, that's who has access. This is a workaday neighborhood with people working hard. They don't know about those art centers. They don't have time to go there. They
right.
don't have money to sign up for a class. But the quality of the conversation was absolutely seamless between the Minnesota Center for the Book Art Workshop or the Penland Workshop and what happened on a corner in Frogtown.
Mm-hmm.
People wanted to know about the material, the machine,
mm-hmm.
the process. They wanted to understand how to do it correctly. They wanted their picture taken. They wanted their sheet of paper. They wanted to know, could they come back and do it? It was a remarkable reminder of how everybody is the same, but how some of us have more access than others.
Right, right.
In the end, we made 2,400 pieces of paper. They were, I should know the size, but they were large placemat size.
Okay.
400 people helped set the table. It was a perfect line down Victoria Street, covered with white tablecloths, our placemats. 2,000, it didn't rain, it didn't blow everything away. 2,000 people sat down, There was a prayer that was read, a poem that was written by a local neighborhood poet that was read at every table. The food was delivered every two blocks. A group of dancers, it had been choreographed, delivered the table, delivered the food to our table. For 2 hours, people sat and talked. Mm. And then at the end, 2,000 people rolled up their placemats and took them home. We were being so careful because we didn't want them to be thrown away. We wanted to collect them to be used perhaps in an artist's book or...
Right.
And when it was time to leave, 2,000 people were leaving holding their placemats. It was so cool to see.
Yeah.
And it was a transformative experience. None of us that participated in the meal as makers or as artists or as people who just sat down, we were changed. I mean, it was just a remarkably powerful, beautiful experience. Setu Jones deserves immense credit, but he's the kind of artist that can open his arms and, you know, the poet and the dancers and the paper makers and the, you know, the food people, we all had ownership, you know.
Right. Well, you deserve enormous credit for everything you coordinated. I just want to ask you about the, you said 90% something.
Oh, 90% of the paper.
What was the other 10?
You know what? I used the Ghanaian kozo.
Okay.
I had brought it back and I thought, this is a perfect application.
Right.
It's also local. It ties this activity to another socially engaged activity that I feel so strongly about. It also worked beautifully aesthetically, mm-hmm. you know, with the local weeds that we were using,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
without making it, you know, it, for so many reasons, it was the perfect thing to use. That's what I used, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Cool.
And also, people here loved the idea that this was Ghanaian material.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. There's a lot of African Americans mm-hmm. in
right.
my neighborhood,
right.
and they're super interested in African culture. Yeah.
Wow. So we need to wind this down,
yeah.
but I wanted to just see, are you working on any artwork or is there another project or anything else that you
well,
want to share?
I think ongoing is production paper making. I have two or three projects a year now. Usually someone will come to me and I produce paper for that. And ongoing right now is in my studio life is a project called Driftless Reveries. I teach it in Madison. I'm deeply connected in St. Paul. It's about a 4-hour drive through a really beautiful country. I make these pieces which are informed, I think, by the landscape here in the Midwest. Of course, I'm forever changed by the time I spend in Ghana, and there's some element of that. I think they're kind of quilt-type approach to
mm-hmm.
To painting. The papers are flax, abaca, Ghanaian kozo, dyed, printed on, drawn on, stitched together in a kind of haphazard, or not haphazard, but in a with a kind of freedom,
mm-hmm.
perhaps not unlike the freedom I had when I started out in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
In a kind of scrappy way, making these large pieces. I think that work I do for myself, I show about once a year.
Mm-hmm.
I'm engaged in some artist book projects, and between teaching and my family and the projects I've already described, it's a pretty full life.
Yeah, let's end with one more. So you teach at the University of Madison, which is where Walter Hamady, this
yes.
big figure in the papermaking world,
right,
started papermaking. Can you just tell us a little bit about the
well,
history
he,
there?
He looms large there. He still is in the area,
mm-hmm.
But he has really cut himself off from the university, and I have not met him.
Mm-hmm.
My most wonderful colleague, Jim Escalante, is... teaches the book arts, and I'm the only one teaching paper. We have a beautiful facility. There's great interest in paper, but there's, just like everywhere, budgets are small, and so keeping that class alive, even when it's a full class all the time, is it still offered a struggle.
Once a year, once a
right
semester?
Right now it's offered once a year, and then independent study type things.
Right, right.
And we're pushing, trying to make that a larger appointment and a larger engagement, but it's political.
Yeah, right.
So.
And I wonder when Walter was there in the heyday even. Maybe it was only once a year.
You know, he just had such an impact generally because he, well, for all the reasons that we all know, but paper was so integral to his book practice.
Right.
That even if there was only one paper class taught, I can't imagine that paper wasn't part of every book class he taught somehow.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
And that was such a lively time, and that had such an impact really on all our lives.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks, Mary. It was great talking to you.
Well.